J.P. Morgan kicks off bank earnings season with a bang.
But the numbers might not be as great as they seem.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It's January the 14th. Coming up, is now the time to revamp the nation's 25-year-old corporate tax code?
And do you lie to your significant other about money? Well, if you do, a new poll finds you're not alone.
But first, J.P. Morgan kicked off bank earnings season this morning with an announcement that it made a $17 billion profit last year. That's up almost 50% from the year before. Yeah, it looks good on paper, but as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon tells us, bank earnings aren't always as they seem.
At the height of the financial meltdown, banks were required to set aside huge reserves to cover expected losses from their bad loans. Now those banks can dip back into those funds and pump up their bottom line. Chris Katowski is a banking industry analyst with Oppenheimer. He says it's true banks can use the cash reserves to inflate their earnings, but he argues the flip side of the same accounting rule made things look worse going into the crisis.
It really penalized earnings a whole bunch back in 2008, you know, when everyone was freaking out to the tune of almost $60 billion, and then this year you put them back.
Katowski says you can argue this kind of reserve accounting distorts what's reported as earnings, but he points out it's also a positive indicator in itself that banks are able to dip into those funds now that they've weathered the storm.
It's happening because credit quality is improving.
Katowski says not only are loan losses leveling out, but there are signs banks will finally start seeing loan revenue growth in the coming year. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Lots of economic data from the government this morning. Consumer prices rose 0.5% last month. That's the largest increase since June of 2009. But most of that price inflation can be blamed on rising gas prices.
And the nation's retailers saw just a little momentum at the cash register in December, including much of the all-important holiday shopping period. The Commerce Department reports retail sales were up 0.6% for the month. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large for CBS Money Watch, and she's with us from New York with some analysis. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So, all right, let's talk about these retail numbers. What's your take, first of all?
I think a little bit light, below expectations. Consumers are still feeling quite a bit of pressure. They still have lots of debt. They're worried about the weak jobs market. And I think there's an increasing concern that housing could continue to be a problem this year.
Now, people, Jill, are going to start getting some tax refunds, right? Are they going to spend that money at the stores? Are they going to pay down this debt? What are they going to do with it?
I think they're going to keep paying down debt and beefing up savings until they feel that the job market has turned. I think that is truly the key in this particular piece of data.
Now, we also got word this morning on consumer prices up 0.5% in December. But if you take out food and energy, that number is lower. How does this affect the overall economy?
You know, I always laugh when they say we strip out the food and energy. Yeah. You know, most people must be thinking, oh, you mean the things that I actually care about and affect me every single day. So listen, when you have to pay more for your food and to fill up your car at the gas station, you're going to have less money to spend. And I think that also ties into the retail sales. They're not going to go out there and spend money on stuff that's a little bit over the top, concentrating on what's important. Keep an eye on this inflation number. I think this is going to be really a big key in consumer spending.
Jill Schlesinger in New York. Jill, thanks.
Great to be with you.
Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is sitting down today with corporate leaders to discuss the nation's corporate tax code. Executives from Walmart, Exxon, and Disney are among those expected to be in attendance. The corporate tax rate in the U.S. is now the highest in the world, but it is famously full of loopholes. For more on this story, let's bring in economist Gary Schilling. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So it's been 25 years since the corporate tax code has been overhauled. Do you think it's time for an update, and what do you think they should do?
Yeah, I think it is time for an update because it's really gotten to be a Byzantine collection of various loopholes plus the standard rate, which in itself is high. And the idea is if you can simplify it, people know where they stand and what they ought to do. And if they do something, I think it will be a refreshing change from what has been a strong trend toward more regulation. That's a natural result of the recession and the financial problems. I just wrote a new book called The Age of Deleveraging, and I point out there that increased government regulation and involvement in the economy is one of the retarders of economic growth, one of the things that's likely to slow it down. So if we can reverse this, that's fine. But bear in mind that this won't be permanent. They do this about every 25 years or so. They simplify it, but then all the changes come in, and the next thing you know, another 25 years later, you need a resimplification.
All right, well, we'll be ready in 2037 or so. But there's not just a federal corporate tax, obviously. There are state taxes that companies have to pay. Illinois this week was in the news because it is raising taxes. The corporate tax there is going to go up from about 5 to 7%. A lot of people are saying companies are going to flee Illinois for neighboring states. Gary Schilling, do you think there's any truth to that?
There is some. Now, I don't think Caterpillar is going to pull out of Peoria, Illinois, where they've been forever, but it will influence some businesses and divisions of businesses that are based in Illinois on the margin. The interesting thing about this is, you know, we have 50 states with 50 independent governments and economic policies, and they really are laboratories for testing new ideas, and in this case, testing whether higher taxes will fly. And what it means is that states compete for business on tax rates and so on. Hey, I live in New Jersey, and of course we got the highest taxes in the country by some measures, and the governor Chris Christie is trying to do something about that. But people are fleeing New Jersey for other states.
All right, Gary Schilling, economist. Thanks so much for talking with us, and have a good weekend.
You're welcome.
Well, from corporate taxes, we go to personal income taxes. There's a change coming this year from the IRS. For those earning less than $36,000 a year, it's now going to be possible to get tax refunds on a prepaid debit card. Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
The pilot program was designed for taxpayers who don't have checking accounts. It'll also help the government. Ron Shevlin is a banking technology analyst with the ITE Group.
This is clearly about their own benefit.
It costs a dollar to mail a check, but just 10 cents to send out a prepaid card.
When we can convert everybody on the tax refund side from checks to electronics, we can save about $40 million a year.
That's Fiscal Assistant Secretary Richard Gregg. The Treasury Department hopes low-income taxpayers will keep using the cards for bills and purchases.
It's also an effort to try to provide a banking service to individuals who may not have a bank account.
If that works, that'll be good news for the Treasury Department's partners, the Green Dot Corporation and Bonneville Bank. They'll get to pocket fees for withdrawing money from out-of-network ATMs. Richard Gregg says the government's been upfront about that.
We made sure that there won't be any surprises for the individual receiving the card.
In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, the 14th of January. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. Now let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. This morning, hundreds of tourists are being evacuated from the North African Mediterranean country of Tunisia. There's a general strike today following a month of deadly violence there. Protesters have taken to the streets.
And people have been speaking out against high food prices and high unemployment and a lack of civil liberties in Tunisia. Last night, the president, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, tried to end the unrest by announcing he wouldn't seek re-election. As a matter of fact, today he dismissed his entire government. He's also ordered a price cut for some basic foods and promised a more democratic society. The BBC's Adam Minot joins us from the capital, Tunis, this morning. Hi, Adam.
Hi there. Good morning to you.
People who don't have jobs and they can't afford food, they've been taking to the streets to send this message to the president. The president spoke last night. Did he do any good?
Well, it certainly did seem to open up the democratic space because people have gathered in their thousands in the middle of the capital, Tunis, this morning to say that they do want change in this country. But the message they're giving is that that change can only come if President Ben Ali stands down. They say that he is leading a corrupt government and the future for Tunisia must be a future without him.
What more needs to happen, Adam, for this violence to stop?
I think, really, the protest has reached such a momentum now that it is going to continue. President Ben Ali said when he spoke to the nation on television last night that live weapons would not be used at rallies in the future. That was welcomed. He said he wanted to open up the country to more free speech. That was the right thing. But the message that the country is very clearly putting out is that this can only happen if he and what is described as his corrupt administration leaves the country as quickly as possible.
The The BBC's Adam Minot joining us from Tunis. Adam, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, it's not just Tunisia where food prices are on the rise. It's happening globally.
Let's bring in Marketplace's Adrian Hill. She's with our sustainability desk, and she joins us now in the studio. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Steve.
So what's going on? Why are these food prices so high?
You know, it's a lot of things. Some of the major grain producers were hard hit by weather. You remember the drought and fires in Russia?
Oh, yeah.
And now the floods in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
The USDA just cut its outlook for global grain supplies, signaling tighter food supply. And we're doing a lot more than just eating food. You know, we're turning it into fuel these days. There's more demand.
And how do the food prices, Adrian, compare to the spikes a couple of years ago, back in 2008? When we saw riots in a lot of the world?
Well, according to the UN, at the end of 2010, the price of food was actually higher than its peak in 2008. Some countries are feeling the increase more than others. Here in the U.S., food prices are only up a tiny bit. But in India, for example, food prices have risen nearly 20%. I talked to an analyst named Maximo Torero from the International Food Policy Research Institute, and he says globally, things are mostly under control.
Right now, there is no reason to have panic. Right now, there is reason to be alert and to understand that this is a tight situation.
All right, tight, but not out of control. So what's the outlook then?
Torero thinks in the short run, with some government interventions, the price increases will be mostly manageable. But like all things market-related, it's impossible to know for sure. And of course, analysts disagree. There's worry that price speculators are going to get involved. They're going to see this bubble and jump on in. There's also concern in the longer run that climate change is going to have a huge impact on food supply. Extreme weather like floods and droughts, not good for feeding all of us.
And one last question for you, Adrian, is as the prices keep climbing, who wins? I mean, someone's doing well, right?
There are always winners, it seems like. Cargill, for one, the U.S. company that produces food and agriculture products and trades commodities, announced huge quarterly earnings this week. They actually tripled their profits. Farmers could benefit, too, if these prices keep going up and they actually get the weather they need to grow their crops.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill with us from the Sustainability Desk. Adrian, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Here's an offer many British high school graduates may find hard to refuse. A major employer there is offering to pay college tuition for up to 100 students and put them on an annual salary, too. Here's the catch. The degree program is in accounting. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The accounting giant KPMG has launched the scheme in a bid to make accounting more sexy. It should, on the face of it, succeed. The firm will not only pay the students tuition and accommodation costs, it'll pay them a salary of $30,000 a year too. There is a downside. Successful applicants won't spend much time chilling out in the student union. In the first 3 years of the course, they'll work around 9 months of the year at KPMG offices under strict supervision. But, says economist Andrew Hilton, accounting can be the gateway to a glittering career in business.
Boring and dreadful though it is for the first 20 years, you emerge at the end as the CEO of a major corporation with, you know, huge bonuses, a vast salary, and a second or third house in the sun.
KPMG admits that it's launched its scheme because of trouble recruiting and retaining staff. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Australian airline Qantas only has two direct flights to the U.S. It flies nonstop to San Francisco, and it flies nonstop to Los Angeles. Well, it is ending the nonstop flight to San Francisco and replacing it with a nonstop flight to Dallas, Fort Worth. Steve, sounds surprising to you?
It is a little surprising. Absolutely. You think West Coast, Australia, right?
You'd think, and at the shorter flight, obviously, but the Dallas airport is, of course, American Airlines' largest hub, so it'll get all those Qantas passengers all around the country via American Airlines, and it's a gateway to a number of destinations in Latin America, so it'll bring a lot of those people to and from Australia. Travel time for the new flight from Sydney to Dallas, it's 15 hours and 25 minutes. So I think if you're going to take that, you better bring a lot of Marketplace podcasts with you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, the 14th of January. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. We'd love to hear from you about what you like and don't like on this podcast. Just go to marketplace.org and click on Contact.
And you can also contact us on Twitter. My address is Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. The extremely cold temperatures across much of the U.S. right now, including right here in New York, have some fleeing to the sunny beaches of Mexico. Tourism along the country's Caribbean coast is expected to grow this year, but scientists say development is ruining the natural wonders that those tourists are going to Mexico to see. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
Biologist Cesar Barrios says when he moved to the Riviera Maya, just south of Cancun, 20 years ago, the road had two lanes.
With the trees coming to your window.
He laughs because we're stuck in six lanes of traffic. There are 20 times the hotel rooms that there were when Barrios arrived. People come here to see a massive coral reef that's so close to the shore you can wade out to it. Jasmine Zevig and some friends bought fins and snorkels to see their favorite animal.
We're going to see the sea turtles.
They don't need a guide or a permit.
Just going to go on our own. You can swim right out there.
And Cesar Barrios says that presents a problem. The reef hasn't been managed. It may look fine to newbies, but it's actually half dead. He says unfettered access, rising ocean temperatures, and increased pollution from hotel sewage has led to a tipping point for local dive shops.
Because they're losing the business.
And hotels will soon follow, he says, unless local officials accept slower economic growth. And they say they want to. Ecologist Paul Sanchez Navarro is helping government calculate the real cost of new hotels. He says every new hotel room is equal to 18 new full-time residents. He reaches out to educate locals.
To make sure that the cleaning lady of the hotel room understands that if the reef dies, she loses her job.
When Fairmont Hotels built its Mayacoba Resort, it preserved native mangroves to prevent beach erosion. It treats its sewage and conserves water and power. Manager Lynn Santos says the best option for the ecosystem would be no new hotels, but that isn't economically or politically realistic.
We cannot stop development, but we can use it in an intelligent way and with science behind.
And she says that compromise is progress. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
And if that story made you want to go on vacation to Mexico, you can check out photos and more information about the Riviera Maya at marketplace.org.
Yeah, I'm ready right now, thank you. And I'm in sunny L.A. How about that?
That's so, right.
All right. Finally, Jeremy, a new poll shows a third of Americans lie to their spouses and partners about money. Oh, my God, what a surprise.
Go figure.
Yeah, I can't believe this. Harris Interactive did an online survey. It showed more than 30% of couples were not truthful about issues concerning their combined finances. When they have like joint accounts and things like that. Both genders, according to the poll, lie in equal numbers. So there's no villain in this, right? Well, at least there's not one gender that is more villainous than the
we're
other.
We're all equally guilty.
That's right. The most common untruth among couples, Jeremy?
Yeah.
Not telling the significant other about hidden cash.
Like, oh, wow.
I've got
like,
this
like
amount
in the
of
mattress
money.
Or something?
Yeah, maybe under the mattress, maybe it may be in a bank account. The most common result of these?
Yeah.
A heated argument because of the other's so-called financial infidelity.
That's a new term for 2011. Maybe that'll get into the Merriam-Webster top terms of the year, financial infidelity. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.